Hi there, everybody. This is Tracy Malone from NarcissistAbuseSupport.com. I am here with a very special guest today. Michael Sunset has written a book about his journey divorcing a female narcissist. We don't get to talk to very many male victims and those that have come through the other side. Michael had some pretty terrible things happen, scapegoating, the lies, the false allegations, the financial abuse. There's so much in his book that I think that you all need to read it, but I brought him here today and we're gonna start to look at some of the things that he went through and maybe his experience can help you. Men do get abused. So let's welcome Michael. Hi, Michael. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you for having me.
Well, you know, I really wanted to talk to you because so many men go through what you went through, and I want people to understand how painful it is, because narcissistic abuse doesn't just happen to women.
Right.
So let's start with the basics. So you wrote a book. The book is called A Mind is a Terrible Thing to Manipulate, Narcissistic Abuse, the Psychological and Emotional Torture You Don't See Coming. So obviously there's a story behind all of this. So let's start off with the basics, because what I want people to understand is we didn't marry a monster. They turned into one. So when you first met your wife, what attracted you to her?
I thought she was an attractive person, and we were playing cards actually at a mutual friend's Super Bowl party. And she was just laughing, joking around like she was one of the guys, and that's really what attracted to me, or her to me.
Fun and exciting.
But yeah.
How long did that last? When did you start to see the crazy?
Well, I mean, the person's not bad all the time. So, I mean, in the beginning, it was, you know, vacations and a good job, and family members had a great job and seemed like they really had it together. But as time went on, I would say right around the time of being engaged and living together, mm-hmm. The ring was not big enough. So that was one thing, but you know, there was kind of a devaluing. Everything wasn't good enough, gifts or whatever it was. So it started to shift, but again, they're not bad all the time.
Right.
So there's something that kept you thinking it's going to get better, or hey, this person can be reasonable, and that wasn't really the case.
Right, and it's the intermittent like kindness, and then like what was that we just like struggled with in the beginning, because we just like got engaged to them. We're not going to go, oh, I'm just getting used to living with them. We make excuses. Did you make excuses as well?
Yep.
It's real easy to do that. So how long did you end up being married for?
It was about 3.5 years before it fell apart, and then it ended up being a total of 5 years with the divorce process dragging out.
Wow, so it took a year and a half for the divorce?
Yep, the separation and divorce, and a lot of that was just getting continuances and dragging things out, and like I said, it was torture.
Yes, you know, these narcissistic divorces, my book is coming up, and it has to do with you can't make this shit up, because people just, you say the things and they're just like, no, that didn't really happen. So you have a child with her as well, right?
Yep.
Okay. So let's jump into the book and start to talk about, I know that in the book, I read it over the last few weeks, and I think it's a really helpful, like sort of a documentation of what happened and how horrific it really got for you. So let's start off with some of the things that maybe you were accused of.
Well, in the beginning, I was accused of having a mental illness. So I kind of stood up for myself, and it was a not a reasonable request. He had asked me for $50,000 to stay home and focus on her health. And I set a boundary and said, no, I just wasn't comfortable. I mean, I felt like we were being pushed, financially, mm-hmm. Past our means as it was. Mm-hmm. So I needed a psych evaluation because of that, and
wow,
I needed therapy. So I did go see a therapist, And he said, "You're very logical, reasonable, level-headed, but you need to bring your wife with you." So my ex-wife brought my sister behind my back. And the therapist called because he needs my permission. Mm-hmm. "Hey, your sister's here." And I said, "Well, you know, I have nothing to hide. That doesn't make sense. But yeah, you have permission to talk to them." So my sister and my ex-wife had this theory how I'm having a manic episode of bipolar, and that didn't add up to the therapist. So he was not a competent therapist, and I needed to have a psych eval somewhere else. So I agreed to it. And every new mental health professional is just a new opportunity to manipulate and try to convince them that I did have this severe mental illness.
They were calling you bipolar, right?
Yep. And my anxiety kept increasing, depression, things like that. So I actually started to identify with some of the symptoms.
Mm-hmm. But did the doctors, you said you went to a lot of doctors, did they comply?
There was one that was manipulated by my sister and my mother calling behind my back to say that I was paranoid and suspicious of others and, you know, irrational. And you know, when you have people that appear to be loving and caring saying those things about you, you figure it must be true. So I did start to take medication, and I wasn't feeling well, obviously, because you're in these situations, you kind of become numb, paralyzed, anxious, and you know something's wrong. You just can't really put your finger on it right away.
Did you, like, I mean, at that point, in the early stages of this crazy, you were being manipulated to think that you had a personality disorder, a mental disorder, bipolar. Did you actually feel at any point that, like, yeah, maybe I do? Or is it just because everybody was ganging up against you?
Not in the beginning. And I said, "Look, I'm going to go and stay with my parents until we get the results of this psych eval back." And so I packed my stuff and I ended up just going to my parents' house, because it first came back that it was an adjustment disorder, which is like a situational depression, which are those anxiety, depression, you know, all those symptoms that I actually was suffering from. But as time went on, and then the divorce papers were served and my daughter was being kept away from me, then I started to believe it, because I was sinking into a severe depression.
Mm-hmm. Right. Well, anybody would get depressed if they were held away from their child. I read in the book that there were a lot of lies besides the bipolar, you know, diagnosis, that, like, your mother and your sister in the book play a big role to the fact that they were almost ganging up on you with your wife.
Yeah. It's kind of like just getting attacked by a pack of wolves. It's and you're in a weaker, vulnerable position, and they, instead of supporting you, which they are saying, "Oh, we're just trying to help you," and we just, you know, it's the opposite of help. You know, I said, we can't substitute the word help for abuse anymore.
No. And it seems that, I mean, you moved back in with mom. So did it increase and get crazier when you were there?
Well, then I started to have a hard time falling asleep and staying asleep just because of the stress. And I would fall asleep either on a recliner for like 3 hours or on their couch. And then, you know, I would take clonazepam or whatever medication to try to calm down. I would wake up in the middle of the night, take it again, and fall asleep for another 3 hours in a spare bedroom. So, I mean, I was completely isolated. I didn't feel like I had a lot of support, because I just felt like I was alone.
Mm-hmm. Well, you were, unfortunately. So what happened next? Where did the lies go?
Well, they went to the court system. Tried to make me out to be, you know, mentally ill and not a fit father and not responsible because our daughter has a pet allergy and she's coming home with a rash on her butt from the pet allergy. So I later had her tested for a pet allergy and she didn't have one. So it was just kind of one thing after another in co-parenting counseling sessions. Mm-hmm. And I just felt like I was defending myself, and I just got to the point where it was so exhausting from defending myself. I just fell into that severe depression and checked myself in, said, you know, I can't do this on my own anymore. I need help, and went to an intensive outpatient program. And she actually used that to try to go after sole custody and more evidence of why I had this severe mental illness.
But she didn't get sole custody at first. I mean, she didn't get that, right?
She didn't, but one of the mistakes that I made when we first went to court, we had a temporary custody order that she wanted with three hours on Wednesday nights and then every other weekend with no overnights. Any reasonable request I had, she would just say, I disagree. And you know how they have, narcissists have a disagreeable personality. So anything reasonable was, I disagree, and somehow that was okay at family court. So I was encouraged by the lawyers to sign a temporary custody agreement that gave me 3 hours on Wednesdays, every other weekend with no overnight. So my recommendation to people, if it's doesn't seem reasonable, I wouldn't sign it. And the lawyer just said, it'll take us a while to get in front of a judge. So, you know, you should just sign this to have something in place. And that was just difficult to hardly see my daughter at all. It just made the situation worse.
And it's difficult to undo that. When we accept an early plea like that, or an arrangement on a plea, but when we accept something that is 3 hours on Wednesday and every other weekend, then when you go for more custody in the actual divorce, was that a harder battle? Because they're like, well, you had this time. How did that, you know, manifest?
Yeah, it was difficult. So I came out of the intensive outpatient program, started to have Wednesday night and every other weekend with our daughter. And I signed that as a custody order. So I had Wednesday night and every other weekend, which isn't a lot. For somebody that has the time and really wants to be involved with their daughter. But then the actual divorce was dragged out another 9 months. So I had to try to get a little bit of time. She said, well, he can have dinner on Monday night. Well, he can, you know, it's like little crumbs of like they feed you just a little bit at a time. So it went all the way up to a trial, a 2-day trial that it was scheduled for. And she had some tactics to try that there are in the book of trying to get as much money as possible that she could out of the divorce. So it was clear she didn't have our daughter's best interest in mind. She wanted to get the child support. So she had that. But it was tougher. And I did get a couple more dinner nights thrown in. Mm-hmm. But it still was, you know, 25 to 30% of the time is not a lot.
No. So where does it stand now that the divorce is over?
Now it is a shared parenting plan because I went back. I had us both psychologically evaluated. I learned as much as I could about narcissism. I found a high conflict lawyer that understands narcissism and these types of personalities. And our case went right to the high conflict pile, and we had a full custody evaluation with psych evals, and I was able to lay out exactly how the relationship and parenting went, and an experienced evaluator was able to catch it.
Well, that's good. Yeah, you know, I find that the parenting plans with a normal lawyer that's just writing down lines, they aren't quite as detailed as they need to be, because they always seem to find a loophole and they always seem to take advantage of you. Is that something that you thought that she was doing along the way?
Oh yeah. I mean, her lawyer was very aggressive and maybe had some of the same type of traits, where mine was more willing to compromise and reasonable, and that's not what you want in these situations. Mm-hmm. But she had written in, I needed to get a quarterly letter for my mental health, and just things that are not written into any custody order. It was very strange. And then of course, once it flipped and they learned that she had a personality disorder, she didn't want anything about mental health written into it.
Wow. So
it was really interesting the way that everything happened. Yeah.
And I remember reading in the book that at one point, and I don't know where this was in the spectrum of things, but at one point she was the supervised. Did you have supervised visits, but she was the one that was supervising them?
Yeah. So when I was in that intensive outpatient program, which was, you know, a number of group therapies during the week for a period of about 6 weeks, she would come to my parents' house and she would be the supervisor for the visits for about 30 minutes to an hour. That was very uncomfortable. I had asked if we could have a neutral person, and they allowed her to be the supervisor. So I just kind of had to deal with it.
I have never heard that. I have only heard of the objective people, because generally on a supervised visit, I mean, they are taking notes. I've seen the notes in cases where, you know, okay, mommy just, you know, gave the children, you know, four bites of crackers and this, and everything is detailed. And this couldn't have been a situation if she's just sitting there staring at you and making you feel awkward and you can't really be with your daughter the way you want to be.
Yeah, it was uncomfortable. It was tough.
How do exchanges go now? I know this isn't even in the book, but I'm just
crazy. Yeah, and I didn't really talk about it in there, but for a while I would pick her up either at her parents' house or her house, and I would advise not to go into the house for anybody if you have to, or don't be alone with them and the kids. I would pull up on the curbside and pick her up that way, just because the false accusations and the he said, she said, I just wanted to avoid all of that. And they're not bad now.
Well, good. Yeah. Good. It's about finding a plan that works. But yeah. I know in the book there was some things, and I actually highlighted them. So I'm going to read. So your wife basically did a lot of parental alienation tactics to you that you list in the book. And it says the worst one was mommy technically wants you to get sick so she can have all the time with me. And then she said, you know, I feel like mommy froze my heart. Mommy says you lie all the time. Mommy says daddy's house isn't really my house.
Yeah, that was tough. Yeah, she'd get a little hostile with me and my daughter and, you know, tell me I was a bad daddy. And then, you know, sometimes I ask to call you and mommy says it's past your bedtime. And it was, you know, she made an effort not to let me call to say goodnight. You know how if you're calling somebody and the phone cuts out after one or two rings, you know, somebody kind of hit that button on the side of the phone to hang up. So that was happening. There was one time on Thanksgiving, I said, you know, she said, call me on Thanksgiving, and they were at Disney. And I tried to call a couple times. And then the next day, my daughter told me, like, she left me a really nice message. I said, oh, I didn't have a missed call from you, or, you know, I didn't have a message. So you can kind of put it together that she would let her think she was calling me, and it went to the voicemail, and she would leave a voicemail thinking she was leaving the voicemail for me, but it really wasn't. She really wasn't calling me. So, you know, you have the phone calls, you have medical appointments. I wasn't notified of medical appointments. She was trying to keep me out of her life as much as she could. Yeah.
Wow. Well, I'm glad that you won that battle, and I hope that it doesn't continue, because once an alienator, always an alienator. And fighting that is never fun, but you seem to be in a groove where you've got good time with your daughter, and that's helpful.
Yeah, it's tough to defend against. I think it will always continue. And, you know, I believe that my mother is on this spectrum somewhere, and she still talks negatively about our father. But, you know, they are still together. He's not going anywhere. He chose to stay. Mm-hmm. That's just kind of how it's always going to be. But
so how's the relationship with your mom and your sister and you now?
Well, they just, you know, we're not allowed to talk about it. They don't want to talk about anything, but, you know, they had a lot to say, but they don't want to process, you know, the issues in a healthy manner. So you kind of observe the behavior for 4 years and you see that it's not going to change. So, you know, you just have to change the way that you look at it. And, I'll still make time for our daughter to see them. Mm-hmm. But I limit the contact and I limit the time. It is difficult. You know, she attends their, they run a dance studio, and they kind of manipulated to have her attend the dance studio and summer camps all summer and trips to the beach house. And, you know, my daughter does want to do those things. So I kind of have to suck it up. Yeah.
And that cuts into your time, right?
It does.
Time, but you're still willing to do that, which is really the whole thing. I mean, her grandparents are her grandparents, and so you're doing the right thing. That's noble.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, if it wasn't for our daughter, I'm not sure I would have any contact with them.
That's got to be so hard. So let's just talk about something else. When, being a male, and I don't get to have very many men. I coach lots of men, but I don't have very many men who have been survivors and gone through this and look at it from a high perspective, like you're looking down on it now, not in the fire as some of the people are. How did people react to you? And I know you said your friends were kind, but, how do I say this? That very often men don't get believed for being abused. How did people react to you?
Yeah, if I started to talk about it, and people that think my mom and sister are these wonderful people, and, you know, my ex is, you know, has it together, and they don't really know the whole story, I was looked at a little bit differently. Or, you know, you talk about this a lot, you know, and people that haven't been through it, they don't really understand. So it's tough. You kind of have to stick to people that understand, or therapists, somebody that gets it, or my identical twin, who also witnessed everything, was a really good support person. But some friends from home kind of looked at me differently, and you know, that's just how it goes. You lose toxic people, and lose some people that maybe didn't have your back, and find out who your true friends are and true support people are.
I heard something last week, and someone said that trauma changes you forever. Can you?
Absolutely.
How and where it changed you?
100%. I don't know. I mean, I used to be very competitive. I was a three-sport athlete. I was more focused on the external rewards, and that's, I guess, just how to get validation from the family that we grew up in. But now I think I don't have much of an ego at all. I just kind of look at things neutrally, mm-hmm. just not so focused on myself, just focused on the big picture a lot more.
Do you think that you'll trust people the same as you did before?
Well, that's been the toughest thing. I think it's just knowing that this isn't your fault and forgiving yourself, building trust with yourself. You can't build trust with anyone else until you build trust with yourself. And you know, I went from disconnected and dissociated to more connected and present, and that's been huge. So I'm just starting to connect with people, you know, much better, and better late than never. I mean, 38, it's kind of late, but better late than never.
I'm ahead of you. I had 20 years on learning all this, so you know, it is actually going to change you for the better. Because you're going to be more cautious, you're going to be more careful, and yes, you might be less trusting, but that's a protective not trusting, right? You're going to wait till they prove that they're trustworthy instead of freely giving our trust again.
Yep, definitely. Yeah.
So let's roll this up and say, what is the most important thing that you want, let's just say men, to know about going through this and surviving out the other side like you did?
I mean, I think the best way to defend yourself is actually to not react to this type of abuse, or, you know, through text messages, or, you know, the natural reaction is to try to reason with people, and that actually doesn't work. It actually makes things worse. Mm-hmm. So by not proving your point, just kind of sitting back and finding a way out. So I think living under the same roof, I don't think you can be healthy. You're probably not healthy. You know, you need to separate yourself and kind of observe from a distance for a while, and then you'll see that everything starts to change. You get healthier, and you'll realize, you know, why was I so upset? Why did I miss this person so much? This is just not a good person for me. You know, you have kind of withdrawal symptoms, I think, in the beginning, and that lasts for a little while, but you think, if I go back, I'll feel better. Maybe it'll get better. But that's not the case. You need to keep going away.
Yeah. And once you see it, you really can't unsee it. So right. Becomes really hard. I mean, a lot of people go back. A lot of people just say they miss them. They promise to be good. They promise they'll go to therapy. And as you've proven, that didn't work so well. But, the trauma that you have been through is something that has shaped you for the better. And whether it feels like it when you're in the fire pit or, you know, you wait a few years and you get through the other side and you find yourself stronger. You wrote a book.
Definitely. Yeah, I mean, you feel like it's never going to turn. It's never going to get better. How am I going to get through this? And then it changes. You just have to just keep pushing.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being on the show today, Michael. We're going to put the link to your book down below. As I said, I read it in the last week or so. It is worth reading. It is really helpful to identify and say, oh, that's happening to me, or that will help protect me during this part. He's got a lot of helpful advice. So we'll put the link down below. And thank you so much for joining me, Michael.
Thanks for having me.
Thank you so much for joining me. This has been a great interview with Michael, and I hope that you all learned something. And this is for the men out there. You are not alone. And this is a journey that will end, and you are going to have to defend yourself, and you are going to have to get through this. But I promise you, one day the other side will be there, and you will be like Michael. Maybe you'll write a book. Maybe you'll just help others. Let's see you be a Sir Thriver. This is Tracy Malone. And if you have any needs for some resources, maybe looking up some where support groups are or how to find the right therapist, visit my website and we will help you get the answers that you need. Thank you so much and have a great day.